on where it is, and the consumption stayed at the same level or even went up. So that's my point with regard to the statistics, the, whether or not the consumption actually went down during that time. Also, whether or not anybody ever quit consuming alcohol, the question is, why would anyone choose to quit? Under the force of prohibition, many people had no choice but to quit. The alcohol was not available to them in any form. I grew up in a state where it was prohibition. There was prohibition. There was moonshine, and you could buy White Lightning, and we did growing up.
What state was that?
North Carolina. They voted in
needle exchange state, I might note.
Oh, it is?
Yes, well, five states.
How do they get away with it under Jesse Helms, I wonder? What a the most racist state in the nation, I mean, as I understand it now, with Jesse Helms at the head. And how did they get away with that?
He's on the federal level. Maybe the state legislature says
well, they voted it in, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. They got the worst, I understand they have the worst of all the federal correctional institutions in North Carolina nowadays, equal to Marion, Illinois. I have no idea. Really. Anyway, the point is that when you don't have access, you haven't cut back your consumption of alcohol by choice. It's by necessity. You have no choice. So I really mistrust the statistics that anybody would quote showing that alcohol consumption went down. If it went down at all, it was necessarily not by choice. All of these substances, if they were available, I don't even like the word substance or substance abuse. People in poverty, I've been in poverty, I know what it's like to walk the streets all damn night and wait for breakfast and try to hustle spare change for a cup of coffee and can't find one and smoke a grab a smoke to kill the hunger, you know, and later on that day, you finally got enough change for a cup of coffee, and then you got maybe a slice of bread or something, and you're waiting on a donut, half a donut, like some, you walked into the Mediterranean, say, and somebody left part of their apple pie on the table.
You can't touch that food. We're going to throw it away now.
Right, but back then, the Mediterranean was pretty nice about it. They didn't mind you if it wasn't a swarm of people doing it. Anyway, so later on in the day, somebody comes around with some beer, some alcohol. Man, you need some relief. It's a damn necessity. In any event, the root cause of all of this is the desolation out there, the poverty where people are forced. We're all forced into circumstances we would not choose to be involved with, just to get a little relief. You know.
Well, what about cocaine addiction?
What about cocaine
addiction? Cocaine is a rich person's drug in many cases. I mean, here are people who they're not, poverty has not forced them to take lots of cocaine, but suddenly they're spending their entire job wages, they're selling all their stuff in order to get cocaine. Now, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I had a line of cocaine several years back.
Oh, no,
arrest
this.
I inhaled through my nose. I haven't had crack, and I don't really, I don't choose to go cocaine. I think the real solution to it is to allow us to import cocaine leaves, and we can chew them like the people in the Andes do, and
so
get it on the natural.
Be a nation of cocaine leaf chewers?
Right, cocaine leaf chewers, absolutely. We have a right.
Leafing it alone, it all day.
As people of the earth, we have a right to that, just as we have a right to peyote and psilocybin and all the rest of it, I say. But the thing is that it's an incredibly profit making business for the secret government, as I hear, as it is the CIA in control of the cocaine importation and so forth. They could shut down the cocaine manufacture in South America instantly by stopping the exportation by the large oil companies of the huge barrels of petrochemicals necessary to process cocaine leaves into coke powder. They could do that tomorrow, but it's an incredibly profitable business for the petrochemical industry, so they're not going to do that. Also, they worry that if they stop, then the Venezuelan oil barons would ship it. But if they stop the Americans from the United States financial barons from shipping their petrochemicals, they could interdict the Venezuelans just as well. It's a big deal. The point about taking cocaine or crack on the streets is there are studies that show. Although I utterly mistrust any of these damn psychiatrists, psychologists, psychotherapists, or any of the rest of them in their studies. Actually, I'm not even going to mention the rat study. Everybody knows about the rat study. The rat is given an opportunity to push a lever, and one lever gives the rat food and the other cocaine, and the rat chooses cocaine until it's dead. Be that as it may, for whatever reason, a person may get stuck on cocaine. There's another industry at the other end of this thing called addiction. You're supposed to be addicted to these damn drugs. It's not that you like them or you like to take them or that you like the experience you have behind these drugs, this cocaine or any of the rest of it. You're addicted to it. So the whole language of the addiction industry is geared to get you in the position where if you go for one line of cocaine, you're going to get us stuck with 20.
Are you denying the reality of either psychological or physical addiction, John?
I mistrust the language of the whole addiction industry. I think we should dump it and find our own particular vocabulary. There used to be a vocabulary of the street. You were hooked. You had a monkey on your back. I think that language in that culture had greater meaning and was more personally understandable within the culture than any of this 12-step addiction language where you're codependent or dependent and all the rest of that crap.
Right, but aren't we, I mean, that may be a pungent and significant criticism to some extent of that kind of language, but aren't we talking about something real? For instance, when I was in Santa Barbara, I met a man who had been an engineer and apparently developed some interesting inventions in the issue of radiocardiology. I met him working in a Goodwill addiction program. He was articulate. He was originally from Poland, spoke very eloquently, and he talked about how his life had changed. That he became addicted to crack cocaine because, and admittedly, he didn't say crack cocaine grabbed me and, you know, did this and that to me. He had a relationship that had broken up with his wife and problems with his family. But he did note that there was a real addiction that happened in the sense that he had been smoking it occasionally, and then one day he kept smoking it all day. He just kept doing it because he couldn't face the downside of what happened when he stopped smoking crack. And I know of a local activist who I won't name who has smoked crack cocaine, and she was able to get off the drug, but she said it was very addictive. She smoked it once, and she kept smoking it for several months, and she even took up prostitution as a consequence of this for a while. So, I'm not saying one shouldn't have the choice, but what about the issue that's always raised by those on the right of the social consequences of these drugs? How do we deal with those realities?
The social consequences of that. Let me go back just a moment to this guy who one day smoked it all day. I attribute that in part to the mindset that we get into where we are supposed to quit the drug altogether. That we're going to have a last one. We're going to have a last cigarette. We're going to have a last drink. We're going to have a last line of cocaine. Let me make the point, please.
Sure.
The point I'd like to make is that there in an enlightened society, even processed synthetic crack cocaine could, I think, have a place where people understood its potency, understood its how wonderful the feeling was, and so forth, and were occasional users of it instead of strung out on the damn stuff. where you are, as it were, helterly, skelterly, in between your hit, looking for your next connection, you know, to get your next hit, put so much pressure on people that when you and plus the terrible effects of surveillance and worrying about neighbors and worrying about cops coming around the corner or knocking down your damn door with a log or something and coming busting in, all of these factors work to force people against their will into a situation where they take it when they can get it. We take it when we can get it. The fact that you can have what they call a dependency on this stuff, a physiological dependency on this stuff, or a psychological dependence on this stuff, I mistrust the whole system so much that I don't trust their understanding and their analysis of that situation. And I don't really trust people who tell their stories about how they got off it, how they quit on 12 steps, how they're clean and sober now, how they're no longer dependent or codependent, or how they're in recovery and all of that stuff. I don't trust any of it. There's a book at the library that goes into some of this stuff, especially on the Alcoholics Anonymous level, called The Diseasing of America by a man named Stanton Peel, which might be worth reading for some of you out there.
How do you spell
Peel? P-E-A-L-E, I believe. I'm not sure. But The Diseasing of America is one of the books. In any event, I just don't trust it. I'm not so confident in myself that I'm going to be able to come up with an analysis of the physiological aspects of it. There obviously are changes that occur in us physically when we ingest anything, you know, and something in the potency of crack cocaine, as I understand it, you can drop dead instantly from a heart attack, and some people reportedly have. I don't know the high. I know the high of the energy behind a line of cocaine, like going for 8 hours on an energy I didn't really know I had at the time. Of course, it wasn't my
energy.
Send
your cocaine samples in. No, just kidding.
In any event, why should we trust? My question is, why should we trust the reformers or the people who work for the system? Why should we trust their analysis? Why should we trust these people who are in these 12-step programs? Or why should we trust any of their analysis of any of our life situations? I say that we have it, each one of us, curiously enough, we each of us learn to talk more or less by ourselves. And if you think about the complications, how incredible it is to learn to talk, and you watch kids starting to talk and learning to talk, they learn to talk, we learn to talk all together more or less on our own. We learn to walk all together more or less on our own with a few hands here and there catching us, picking us up off our butts. And we learn to talk with people saying, well, no, that's not what that is, that's that. And then we go around, well, what's this and what's that and that over there, and we get the names and we put it together and we're talking. If we can learn to do that, we can learn to handle what they call addiction in our own language, on our own terms, without their damn help, but with our friends' help who are like-minded. I wouldn't trust anything the system puts out.
You know, I tend to share a suspicious critical attitude towards studies issued by people who have an interest in the system. On the other hand,
something else.
Yeah. Before you do, John, I want to. You want to get out of here, or what you're saying?
No. He
wants to append something. Go ahead, append it, John.
I have great sympathy for anybody who's out there strung out on anything. I was strung out for 35 years on cigarettes, and it's difficult to get rid of, to get off them, to get away from them. It's like, for me, cigarettes were an old friend. So it was like getting rid of an old friend. It's hard to do. In any event, I have a lot of sympathy for you, and if you got off by 12 steps and you're staying off by 12 steps, well, that's your way. You chose that way. That's cool. If you're strung out and you think you can't get off, and you've tried 12 steps and failed and you can't get off any other way, why don't you look to your own self, to your own inner being, to your own mind, and stop using the language of addiction to talk about yourself and your situation. Just stop using that language and talk about yourself in your own language that you've always known and always had inside yourself, and see if you can't figure it out that way. Anyway, I have a lot of sympathy for you. I don't know where you're going, if you're strung out on crack. I don't know where we're all going. We all ought to be in a countercultural revolution against this damn system to abolish the capitalist system, which is, as it were, the problem. The solution is to abolish it. And this drug problem is just a, as it were, is exists because the capitalist system requires it to exist, and for no other reason.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that. The the profits that you make off of this, the whole criminalization process, the process of essentially people getting paid a fraction of what they're worth, the kinds of relationships that grow up between people in the,
right,
in the system we're in. And I think your suggestion, I'd love to hear you talk more about, preferably with somebody who actually is grappling with this problem, is finding a new way of describing what others have called, what the system calls addiction, and is seeking a new vocabulary within herself as or himself as to how to frame the issues so that she or he can come to understand in terms of her own experience what is really happening, what her needs are at that moment, how she feels. If we could actually turn that into a sort of a semi-public thing, and I admit that might be a little far-fetched because when you're in the midst of grappling with this, you got your hands full, I imagine, but maybe with someone who has already grappled with this in a future show, we can have her or him discussing the process of changing the internal vocabulary.
All right. Where I'm coming from on that is that I dumped the vocabulary of psychiatry, psychology, psychotherapy, and all the rest of the mental health crap. I don't use any of the language of that ideology, which is what it is, to apply to myself or to my friends. And when my friends or anyone else in my presence starts using that language, I try to work into the conversation, or without, you know, jumping on top of them with both feet, I try to make a point about the language they're using without hitting them over the head with a hammer of it. But in any event, I worked diligently for several years getting rid of that language. I was labeled a paranoid schizophrenic. I was labeled a manic depressive. They almost had me on lithium. They had me on 8 different psychiatric drugs. I went there for help. The help I got was psychiatric drugs and psychiatric language applied to me and my situation. I really thought it was mind readers and mental telepathists and magicians and warlocks who were creating these visions and these voices that I was seeing everywhere I went, and these magic shows that would blow you away. In any event, without recounting any particular one, I really believed that, and only infrequently, as it were, would in desperation because of the dire consequences of being subjected to the manipulation by mind readers, mental telepathists, and magician, which is what I perceived myself to be happening to me, I would flee in desperation to the paranoid schizophrenic definition, and I was hallucinating, and these weren't real, and it was all a chemical imbalance. And if I had run out to San Francisco General and talked to my shrink, and well, that med ain't working, we'll go from, let's go to Melaril now, you know, Stelazine, let's go to Melaril, and then, how about Prolixin, and so on. But in any event, I came down to Santa Cruz in 1976. I was here like 5 years, and in 81, I walked into Loud Nelson, and there was Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective with Jane Kaiser and David Williams and some other people who were in the psychiatric inmates liberation movement, and they weren't talking about being paranoid schizophrenics or that kind of crap. They were talking about being psychiatric inmates. And it was like, what? What's a psychiatric inmate? Well, have you ever been hauled in by the cops and injected and force-treated? Yeah, and so on and so forth. Anyway, I got my introduction to a political perspective on psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry. And I took seriously the statement in the Declaration of Principles from the 10th Conference on International 10th International Conference on Human Rights and Psychiatric Oppression, which says that the language is just damn jargon. So from then on, I started catching the phrases that as I would think about myself or other people, I would catch my thoughts on those things. And in catching my thoughts, I began to get rid of them. I would examine the thought that I was a schizophrenic. What did it mean? Where did it come from? How did I get involved with it? Why do I want to call myself that? Why do I want to call anyone else that? So I would examine those thoughts, so it was like for 5 years I worked on that. Longer, you know, I still work on it. I still catch myself occasionally referring to someone as a man having a mania or something, and so I catch that and I work on it and I discard it. I refer it back to from where it came, which is this the psychiatric patriarchy, which grew up inside of the European-American patriarchs, who are white supremacists, male supremacists, and Christian supremacists. How do you want to use their language to talk about my inner being? Fuck it.
Well, you know, I think...
Oh, excuse the language.
Yep, certainly. We wouldn't want you to use that kind
of
language.
That's a good word. Why should I use that word to refer to something bad?
Indeed. It's an exclamation... which is often used in many different contradictory senses. But here I see something interesting in your discussion, and I may have to try to pin you down on this in future in future discussions, or even now if we have time. I don't know. It depends on when the next host comes in and how much time you have. But we're always talking about opposing the system, opposing, and indeed is a significant aspect of what we're doing here. Yeah, go ahead. John is having a coffee fit and addicting himself to a 7-Eleven coffee here. And sugar, I might add.
Another drug.
Though we talk about opposing the system, I think that is a very significant aspect, weaving out from our consciousness and from our behavioral responses the impact of this system. What about the alternatives? See, and this is something, for example, that I'm a bit concerned about in my own dialogue with the community. I talk about the hosts are bad and the police actions around homeless people are bad and the sleeping ban is bad. I say all these things. But what are the alternatives I'm proposing that could propose a concrete difference? And simply to say, getting rid of all this, yeah, sure, but then what? What exactly do we want to create in its place? And sometimes I admit the very act of destruction is a creative process. And out of that destruction comes ideas and concepts and possibilities that we could not even conceive of while that oppression was in place. But, for example, when you are talking about finding a new vocabulary, I think, and I don't know if you're prepared to share this with us because it's probably very personal vocabulary, having people see the process of a person who has actually, you know, both sent back the psychiatric terminology to its home ward, where it came from, to its to the pharmaceutical industry where it originates, you know, to the psychiatric industry is good. What about the new vocabulary that you are putting in place? When you grapple with a problem, are you in a position to share with us the kind of terminology you do use now?
Well, I'll talk about it. I don't have a method. That's the point. There is no method to this. The point is to get back to who you are. The who you are is you're that little kid who learned to talk all by yourself with nobody else helping you. You were talking to yourself. I feel like I was when I was laying there in the crib. I was learning to move my finger by thinking the thought finger move, as it were, in a vocabulary that is not English or any other language that's spoken, but is a thought. When I move my finger, how do I move my finger? That's a thought. So while I was laying there, I was thinking, move my finger like that, move my toes. I was learning my body. I was learning my body all by myself. I was learning to see. I was learning to look around and listen. And then I was learning to talk. I was listening to people say things, and I was listening, and I thought what they were saying, and then I would say something. My earliest memories actually go back to, like, the age of about 4, 5, 6, something like that. They're, like, broken and scattered in there. But the point is that during that time, I was, and I think we all in those times when we're little like that, we're learning our body, we're learning our senses, we're learning, and we're doing it in a vocabulary that we have access to now if we would take the time to try to get to it, which is what I try to do. What I want to do is be in touch with that mind of mine, which some philosophies say is stainless, uncorrupted, original mind. Regardless of that, there is a regardless of the high-flown, as it were, philosophical aspects of this, I must have been somebody then, and that's the me I am who I talk to. I was talking to myself then, I posit that as a fact, that I was talking to myself then in a language that only I know. And I think maybe we're all that way. We talk to ourselves constantly in a language that only we know. And in that language, we know how to solve problems regarding the external world in a way that is uniquely our own. And no one else can tell us how to solve problems in that way. Only we can. So the vocabulary I looked for was that vocabulary, to get rid of the psychiatric vocabulary and talk to myself in that language, which is mostly nonverbal, in fact. For as one example, however, as regards people who call themselves depressed, I used to call myself depressed. People are going around talking about depression and clinical depression and mania and so forth. I thought about that, and it occurred to me that it was like painting a self-portrait. You're given this palette. It's the psychiatric palette, and it has certain colors on it, and you paint your self-portrait in it. Well, or the psychiatrist does it for you. So, but I thought, looking at that vocabulary, that was the bleakest damned palette of colors for an artist to use I'd ever seen, man. So I went and got me a thesaurus to look at a better vocabulary, and I found, like, dejected, despondent, dispirited, and so on, you understand. So when I felt sad, which is the basic word I use, sad, I would try to find the word that fit. Was I really sad? Was it dejected, despondent, out of sorts, bent out of shape by society's pliers,
degenerate,
and so on? But and the effort in trying to find that word, in the end it didn't matter if I didn't find a word. If I did, that was well and good. That felt good. But even if I didn't find the word, the effort in trying to find the word that fit my feelings changed my feelings, got me in touch with my feelings in a way that nothing else I'd ever done did. So just sitting there trying to find the word that fit my feelings, rather than, damn it, accepting depressed as applicable, or clinically depressed, or manic, or any of the rest of these damn words, just trying to find the word, whether I found it or not, was so much worth the effort, because it got me in touch with me. So it's like that's the point. There is no method, as it were. There is no vocabulary except your own inner vocabulary, which you've always been using, as I posit or postulate, vast philosophical premise there. Anyway, get in touch with that. And I'm not talking about the inner child of that guy that...
Eric Byrne.
No, that other guy. He's on KQED during their... anyway, the inner child. I'm not talking about the inner child. That guy is postulating the existence of a separate sort of being that you no longer are. What I'm talking about is something you are, and if you no longer were, you'd be dead, as it were. So what I'm talking about is not that inner child of, I can't remember his name, whoever he is, may he prosper but be seen for what he is, someone different from me.
Yes, discreetly put, John. Well, I think I find that actually quite enlightening, even though you have not described specifically how you engage in dictionary therapy, as we might call it.
Oh, get that therapy word.
She hates the word therapy. Yeah.
Drop that.
Well, let's say dictionary massage.
No, dictionary
exploration.
That's better.
Yeah. Well, I think
thesaurus exploration.
Thesaurus therapy sounds so much more better.
No, I hate it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll put that one aside.
Drop that.
It seems like a very, particularly if you're interested in writing, or even if you're not.
Let me make one point here about the word therapy. If you're, as I've been, if you've ever been on a locked psychiatric ward and you go to group therapy against your will, it's like, how can it be that the word therapy applies to what happens to you under those coercive, intimidating circumstances and something that is supposed to benefit you? I can't abide using that word in that way. So as far as I go, therapy is more like therapist is more like the rapist than it has more in common with the phrase the rapist than with anything else.
Well, I think investigating and exploring your psyche and your feelings with the intention of dealing with your pain, because that's what you're feeling, I guess, when you're sad. That's what you're feeling when you're out of sorts, as we might say.
I try not to use that word psyche either, Robert.
Now, psyche was a fine word in Greece. Let's not malign psyche.
Well, but psyche, the wind, who was left out lone, stony, lonesome on the rock, waiting for I forget the myth exactly, but if you could in your vocabulary restrict yourself to that and only that implication, but you can't. Other people have a vocabulary that includes the word psyche as used by Carl Jung, and so the implications are that of the collective unconscious and the personal unconscious and the archetypes of the collective unconscious and all the rest of the paraphernalia of Carl Jung's analytical psychology, which is anybody's right to go for, but I don't. And psyche also, I feel sorry for the Greek myth that the psychoanalysts, the psychiatrists, the psychologists so corrupted it. Freud and his Oedipus complex and his penis envy. It's more like, here's a cool one for Michelangelo was painting that thing, you know, the Sistine Chapel or something where God's pointing his finger at Adam. I wonder if that wasn't the first gay couple.
Just to hit on Freud and all the rest of it.
It's, but I think, again, getting back to the process of how to create an alternative at the same time as we are destroying that which both the external structures and the internal structures within that are created by those external structures in our society.
Right. What I think is we're already there with all of the different movements. All of the different movements have particular issues which not only point to the problem but also talk about solutions to the problems. Cheney, the people with Earth First, for example, they talk about the problem and they talk about the solution. People like Noam Chomsky talk about the problem and the solution. Michael Parenti, Andrea Dworkin, they talk not only about the problems, the particular problems and particular issues involved, but also the solutions to those particular problems.
What about John Stewart?
What about me?
Yes.
Well, I didn't bring my master plan this morning, Robert.
that's what I'm interested in. I am interested.
This is my master plan.
Okay.
Here it is.
Yes.
When you have a demonstration, when you have a protest, have a sign there that says, the capitalist system is the problem, and the issue we are addressing here exists only because the capitalist system requires that this particular issue. For example, today at the table, it might be appropriate to have a sign that says, the capitalist system is the problem. Downtown ordinances and the anti-homeless laws that these people have in effect, and the existence of the hosts and the brown shirts and the attitudes at Zavato's at various places and the anti-camping thing, all of these exist only because the capitalist system itself requires them to exist. So the problem is the capitalist system, is the solution is to abolish the capitalist system. In the between time, we're here to point out to people and try to raise their consciousness and prick their conscience to, oop, that word in there, terrible, attack their conscience, yeah, to force them to either continue their life of stuck in normalism, and where they're in one of three possible states, I think, they're either asleep and sleepwalking, or they are utterly hypnotized, or they're utterly terrorized by the media patriarchs in as agents for the rest of the white supremacists, Christian supremacists, and so on.
Well, again, I mean, we have returned to destroy the system, see the system as the problem. Again,
no, abolish is not
okay. The solution is to abolish. Okay, abolish in a certain sense means destroy the existing system as it exists, in order that something else may be, because of the evil consequences. I don't know if I agree with you that abolish and destroy.
Well, it's so like then. It's like this.
What do we put in its place?
Well, let me mention one as an example. Vine DeLoria wrote several books about the American Indians. He's an American Indian himself. I've read some of his books. Trail of Broken Treaties, I think, is one. Anyway, in his books, he's written about the solutions to how to end the American Indian Wars, which is to say they're still going on. Leonard Peltier is still in prison. American Indians have no rights, essentially. The land is still being ripped off down there. But the American Indians themselves have solutions to the problem of oppression that they face, the oppression they face. They are the oppressed peoples. They experience the kind of oppression. They understand it from their point of view. We should take their leadership as regards that liberation movement. As regards women's liberation movement, women are the ones who are suffering the oppression. We should take their leadership in regards to their liberation movement. The African Americans are the people being oppressed in as well, and there are there is an African American leadership liberation movement, and we should take their leadership as regards that oppression. There are the Wobblies. I for one take it that one big union is the way to go on that, and I think in the Wobbly literature you can find any number of coherent, well thought out, simple to understand plans for replacing the existing capitalist system with a system which is cooperative, which is concerned for people's rights, which is considerate of each other, and no longer is viciously competitive. I believe that people like Noam Chomsky do have solutions, and the Wobblies, and the fact that we out here don't hear these solutions in the mass media, but that these solutions do exist in literature, which you can search out and research and find, hopefully, I think those solutions do exist. The fact that I don't have in my mind at this moment their solutions does not invalidate the statement I make or the claim that I make that there do exist solutions to the problem, which are, as it were, non-destructive, that would be non-violent, that could be peacefully brought about if the class consciousness of the capitalists wasn't so sharply pointed at our hearts, as it were.
Well, indeed, but again, in looking for statements of substance in terms of actual alternatives, I find this as yet, it's slim pickings here, John, in terms of what you said. And again, I tend to agree with you that, hey,
You don't think the Wobblies have a plan?
Well, the question is, when you and I make these criticisms, do we have a sense of a plan? And my problem is frequently I have to admit that I don't have a very clear plan.
Well, I have one. Yeah. I have one plan.
Okay.
Let's get rid of the welfare system.
Yeah.
They want to get rid of it. Let's get rid of the welfare bureaucracy.
Right.
And we'll have a guaranteed income. For everyone.
You mean shoplifting downtown, or no? No, you're talking about guaranteed, by the government, you're talking about. I mean, I think if you got rid of the welfare system without any other changes, I think people would be reduced to a certain amount. Their desperation level would rise.
No, that's what they're going to do. Yeah. They're going to do it that way, in fact. They're going to get rid of the welfare system. They've effectively gotten rid of it already over the last several years. The welfare system is no longer works for anyone's welfare. It's a bureaucratic squeeze. You go out there, you apply for food stamps, they'll send you through more forms than it would take to open a savings and loan and rob the nation of $500 billion. Keating didn't have to fill out as many forms as you do for getting food stamps or AFDC. And what's the point? Well, the point is to have a mass of unemployed people who will cut each other's throats for jobs, of course. And then all the rich can have even more servants and even more of this and everything else. Anyway, the point is to exploit the working people. A very simple solution to the whole damn problem would be to reinstitute all of the reforms of the 1930s and the New Deal, period. But they know it, and they know that. They know that's the solution of reform, and the fact that they've dismantled all of those reforms proves that the damn system can't be reformed. It's got to be abolished. With regard to abolishing it, it could be done in steps and stages. But back to the welfare system, they're not going to do this one either. The reasonable, simple solution is to have a Social Security guaranteed income from birth to death. So that people don't have to cut each other's throats in competition for jobs and such to live.
In fact,
there's a book down at the library, The Tyranny of Kindness, in which a woman who was who worked diligently in New York State, in New York City, with welfare rights, much like Linda Lemaster here in Santa Cruz with Welfare Parents Support Group. Guaranteed income is the simplest plan. A one-payer plan for national health care is also a very simple and obvious solution to two of the biggest problems. In any event, they're not going to put in either of them. They're going to continue to exploit us, period.
Well, yes, John, but again, yeah. we find the problem is that you're talking about abolishing, but what do we place in place of this stuff?
I just said a guaranteed income.
Oh, guaranteed income. I'm sorry. Quite right.
Right.
So the guaranteed income and a national health plan. So you are essentially sort of the Norman Thomas socialist plan, or is that the idea?
Well, you put me up against the wall for a solution.
But
you wouldn't go for the fact that there is an IWW that has any number of adequate solutions to this problem. You wanted me to be specific. Well, I'm not that well read in IWW. I also make a claim that Noam Chomsky has solutions, and you wouldn't let me get away with that one either. You want me to?
These leaders, these leaders,
aren't cures.
aren't these wise
right,
men with
right.
their solutions.
Well, the, but
these wise white men, I might add.
We talked about the African American Liberation Movement.
Right, but we're
and their leadership.
You didn't mention
in that
any
group.
Names, John.
Oh, well, what name would we mention? Malcolm X and By Any Means Necessary, or Mumia Abdul-Jamal, who's in prison. His prison writings obviously dissect the prison system with a very fine scalpel to expose the rotten inner core of the whole damn thing. What about George Jackson and the San Quentin Six? They did it well as well,
right,
pointing out this stuff. Let's take the Black Panther parties, 13 points for instance. Let's put those into effect.
Well, okay. I mean, that's a thought in the ghettos. I don't know. We're talking about a solution for the nation. The Black Panther Party's programs. But actually, let me introduce another person who has shown up here. And don't, that's not to eliminate you. I think a three-way conversation would be excellent here. Full Heart Phil, who perhaps hates his name, but he's here anyway. To fuck me. Well, perhaps not here on the air at this point, but to. To say his piece, yeah. Have you been listening to us, Phil? What we've been talking about?
I listened earlier this morning, and I got sick of it. And I went out in the world. Now, I think John.
Can
was
you
just
be heard at that
on.
Distance? I don't know if you.
Yeah, I'm watching the needle. I'm a professional at this, you see. So I just raise my voice, make the needle move. I have something to say.
Yes.
I just came from the mall.
Yes.
It's business as usual on the mall.
Uh-huh. Why is that?
Because the businesses are all open and the employees are all working. What I had to say is that
the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of working people. And the few who make up the employing class get shit. Get all the shit. Get everything.
You mean the working class?
No, they get shit.
Right.
They get the shit.
Right.
They get all.